Well, first of all, I want to thank all of you for coming. I want to thank all of you for tearing yourselves away from the first of the long days of summer. Daylight savings time is here, and everybody can go out to play. I want to thank those of you who were who had enough foresight to do your taxes ahead of time. I'm picking mine up Monday, you know, and mail them in at the last minute, as always. And I want to thank you for showing up this evening. There's an old Turkish proverb that says, "He who tells the truth gets chased out of nine villages." And I think there's a lot of merit to that, and I think it's relevant to the talk that I'm going to give this evening. The militia phenomenon, by the way, the title of the lecture this evening is "The Militia Movement, Enemy or Pawn of the State?" And indeed, I think that's a very important question to ask, and I'm not going to present a definitive answer. However, I think I'm going to present information which would suggest a viable working hypothesis under the circumstances. And I think that the rhetoric on all sides vis-a-vis the militia movement has been inadequate. I also feel a little self-conscious because I know Roy has been catering to the militia movement / Patriots Network, and I love Roy like a brother, but at the same time, I'm going to be generally critical of that milieu, although qualifiedly so. I think there has been a gross oversimplification on all sides. There's been the rhetoric has been dichotomized into saying, well, you know, are the militias, you have the militias on one side and the government on the other, and people have not asked the question that I'm asking this evening about whether perhaps the militia movement might actually, or elements thereof, might be a pawn of the very government, a de facto extension of the very government that they are speaking against. My belief is that that is in all probability the case, and I'm going to discuss the background to the militia situation. I'm going to be talking about the history of fascism. This lecture will overlap very heavily some of the lectures that I have given in the past. She Who Remembers has many of the other lectures. I will be as brief as possible. I hope that given the characteristically ambitious scope of the lecture this evening, that it will not be too fast-paced to be intelligible for those of you who have not been at previous lectures. To make a very long story short, and I'm going to attempt to sum up my working hypothesis of this lecture in the beginning, for those of you who might have to leave early, and again, my lectures tend to be very long, I want you to get the basic thrust of what I am speaking about. I think that the militia movement is a mixed bag. I think contained within the militia movement are many sincere patriots and the associated patriots networks. I think there are many sincere patriots, many true conservatives who believe in traditional American conservative value, or conservative values, traditional conservative values as expressed in American the American political landscape. I have no doubt whatever that many of these militia people have the most sincere motivations at heart and really believe in democracy. I think that the phenomenon has been oversimplified in a manner that I have indicated. It has tended to be dichotomized as, well, you've got the government and the militias. I think it's an oversimplification at both ends. The militia movement is very diverse. Many of them are sincere, although for the most part badly misinformed conservatives. And many of them are outright raving fascists and Nazis. I'm going to be talking about both this evening. By the same token, there's been all this talk about the government. Well, the government is very diverse. Who are you talking about? Are you talking about the Securities and Exchange Commission, or are you talking about the Marine Corps? I mean, it's a very, very different set of circumstances for those two elements of the government. And I think in many ways the militia movement and the Associated Patriots networks reflect that same diversity. And consequently, I think the debate on all sides has simply been inadequate. By the way, this lecture is the first lecture of a two-part series. I'm going to be talking about gun control in the second lecture, which is going to be on November 18th. It's going to be on May 18th in Deep River Books. That lecture is going to be called Fascism, Gun Control, and the Intelligence Community. I believe that the militia movement is being manipulated by elements of the very government it professes to be opposed to, and the very government that elements of the militia movement are opposed to. I have spoken about Oklahoma City in past lectures, and I'm not going to dwell on Oklahoma City. I will be touching on it. I think that there are many more questions to be answered about Oklahoma City. My belief, my working hypothesis, and you know, everybody knows what happened at Oklahoma City. I mean, you know, you got the militia, it was the government. You've got the government and the mainstream press, it was the militias. Although now they're not talking about the militias. That's all we heard for the longest time. Now we're just told it was two lone nuts, you know, from the same military unit, along with the informant, who was also part of the same military unit. People are not asking the questions they should about that. I've been studying fascism in the national security establishment for about a quarter of a century, lecturing about it for the better part of two decades, and people who, frankly, don't have the credentials I've got know everything that's happened. I have more questions than answers, but I hope to be able to frame some of the paths of inquiry for you this evening in the manner that I think they need to be framed, because I think the rhetoric on all sides has been inadequate, both on the part of the mainstream press and the government and the so-called alternative press, note the use of the term so-called, who have lined up and said on Oklahoma City, it's the militias, it's the right wing. And then the Patriots networks and the militias plus the conspiracy crowd have been saying it's the government. My belief is that fascist elements within the government and fascist elements within the militias in all probability collaborated with regard to Oklahoma City. And that's one of the reasons why you'll notice after all the flapdoodle about militias in the first week or two after Oklahoma City, then we didn't hear any more about the militias. It was just these two lone nuts who were traveling all over the country with no visible means of support, and yet there wasn't anybody else involved. Well, we're going to talk about that later. I will be touching on Oklahoma City, but not dwelling on it. I also am going to be touching ever so briefly on the Waco incident. In fact, I might as well do that now. It is my considered opinion that the Branch Davidian massacre in April of 1993 and the preceding siege was a domestic intelligence operation intended to not only discredit Bill Clinton, but to feed, to fuel the very militia movement which we are now witnessing. I believe that gun control has in fact been pushed by many of the same elements who want to do exactly that. I'm not going to attempt to sum up, well actually I'll give you as brief a summation of what I'm going to be lecturing about in May as I can. I think that there was a very strong apparent intelligence community connection to the gun control movement. Firearms are such a part of culture, of the cultural environment in many parts of the country that moving to take away guns has a tremendous symbolic and cultural value, and in many ways is going to polarize and stratify elements of our society and drive them to the right, perhaps into the arms of fascist elements within the militia movement, and I believe that is being done quite deliberately. Two of the key terms, vital terms to understand in grasping the working hypothesis that I'm going to present this evening, are polarization and stratification. I believe those are the goals of Waco, a domestic intelligence operation. I believe those were the goals and are the goals of the intelligence connection to the gun control movement. I will be generally critical of the militia movement this evening. I don't know if there are any partisans of that movement here this evening. You may not like some of what I have to say this evening, although it will be heavily qualified. You will love the lecture in May, which I think is going to be one of the most in-depth and eloquent and substantive arguments against gun control that you will ever hear. Gun control is a red herring. I won't go into the lecture. I think it is being deliberately promoted. Guns do not kill people. People will kill people. And the notion that kids, we're seeing all this propaganda about the dangers that guns present to children. Well, a child is 13 and a half times as likely to die in an automobile accident as by a handgun or a firearms accident, and yet we're not seeing a move to restrict people's access to automobiles. On the contrary, they're raising the speed limits. A child is four times as likely to die in a swimming pool as by a gun. We're not seeing any movement to restrict swimming pools. A child is three and a half times as likely to die in a bathtub by drowning in a bathtub. We're not seeing a grassroots movement to replace bathtubs with shower stalls. The overall gun stock in this country has increased exponentially in the last several decades, and yet there's been a 40% drop in gun accidents. And the move against handguns is particularly curious because handguns are much safer statistically than long guns. A, they're easier to lock up. B, long guns are generally stored either on racks or in cases or standing up. X number of those guns are going to fall and discharge and produce accidents. They also use much more powerful rounds. Long guns, they have many more accidents with long guns and much more serious accidents with long guns. So there are many irrational aspects to the gun control argument. I think it is being deliberately manipulated. I'm going to touch on Waco again later on in the lecture. I think that the militia movement corresponds very closely, and I'm going to dovetail at this point, into a history of fascism as briefly as I can, and I'm going to talk about some things that were going on in the Weimar Republic. I think that the militia movement, in many ways, corresponds to what were known in Weimar Germany or in the Weimar period as the National Bolsheviks. The National Bolsheviks had nothing to do whatsoever with Bolshevism or communism. On the contrary, the National Bolsheviks were the most militant wing of and the cutting edge of a right-wing revolutionary movement, a right-wing political movement in Weimar Germany, of which the Nazi Party was the most virulent and successful part, that was called the Konservative Revolution, or Conservative Revolution. The National Bolsheviks had nothing more to do with Bolshevism or communism than National Socialism had to do with socialism or communism. Of course, National Socialism or Nazism is what ultimately resulted from the Conservative Revolution and the militant actions of the National Bolsheviks. One of the aspects of the rise of Nazism in Germany was that it was paved the road to Hitler's success, and by the way, we should never forget that in its inception, the German Nazi Party was a front for Reichswehr intelligence. I've spoken about that in the past. Hitler was an undercover agent for the political department of German military intelligence. In its inception, the Nazi Party was a front for German military intelligence. There was an abortive communist revolution or Marxist revolution in Weimar Germany. To combat that, President Ebert and Gustav Noske, the Weimar defense minister, or the Weimar president and defense minister respectively, put together a series of a group of military organizations, the Freikorps or Free Corps, the Einwohnerwehren and the Zeitfreiwilligenverbande. These were military organizations composed of World War I veterans, hardened by the brutal combat of World War I in the trenches, and right-wing student radicals. They successfully put down the communist revolution. They then remained in power illegally, and proceeded to conduct assassinations of the political opposition in Weimar Germany, ranging all the way from the doctrinaire communist left, people such as Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, the leaders of the German Revolution, the abortive German Revolution, right on up through Walter von Rathenau, the conservative social democrat who was the foreign minister who signed the Treaty of Versailles, the Treaty of Friendship with the Soviet Union, which was outrageous to the German militarists and their supporters within the Conservative Revolution. The German body politic in the Weimar Republic had, even after the revolution, a very large and very powerful doctrinaire left-wing element composed of elements ranging from doctrinaire Marxist socialists through doctrinaire non-Marxist socialists. The point being that there was a very powerful left-wing movement in Germany. It was one of the dominant left-wing movements. Obviously, the Conservative Revolution was opposed to that. The National Bolsheviks were opposed to that. However, the National Socialists, okay, the Nazis, employed that name, National Socialists, to deliberately take advantage of the socialist and Marxist sympathies of people within the Weimar Republic. There was an entire wing of the Nazi Party, the social revolutionary wing of the early Nazi Party, that was composed of disaffected Marxists and socialists. They specifically enlisted in the Nazi Party under the leadership of a fellow named Gregor Strasser, and they enlisted in the Nazi Party in order to overthrow corporate capitalism and the strangling powers of international finance, which were generally linked in Nazi propaganda with international Jewry. That same sort of propaganda is something that we're witnessing within elements of the militia movement today. Once again, the Jewish banking conspiracy myth is rising to the surface and enjoying an amazing amount of success. Just FYI, the myth of the Jewish banking conspiracy is just that. Of the 10 largest commercial banks in the world, 7 of them are Japanese, not a whole lot of Jews in Japan. The remaining 3 have the Deutsche Bank and Dresdner Bank, both of which are German commercial banks. Not a whole lot of Jews there. They were liquidated in World War II. And the other is the Chase Manhattan Bank, controlled by the Rockefeller interests, and they are most assuredly not Jews. In fact, they aligned with the Third Reich in World War II. One of the characteristics of the early Nazi movement, and in particular one of the characteristics that I think is important to understand in assessing the contemporary militia movement as well as the rise of Nazism in Germany, is ideological mystification, the deliberate mystification of ideology. This was central to the early rise of Nazism, and I believe that there was a very close parallel between the National Bolsheviks today in the National Bolsheviks in Weimar Germany and the militia movement today in the United States. And I think that the same type of ideological mystification, although somewhat different, is being employed today. In past lectures, I've spoken about the rise of Nazism and I've spoken about fascism. It was the ultimate corporatist philosophy. In fact, Mussolini termed fascism corporatism, and he termed his system the corporate state. And indeed, that's why many of the doctrinaire, anti-communist, anti-labor, and pro-corporatist stance of fascism and Nazism was what endeared it to many of the world's most powerful industrial and financial interests. Hence, they supported fascism. The social revolutionary wing of the Nazi Party and the National Bolsheviks were employed by the brown shirts, the Sturmabteilung, as street fighters. A lot of them were very tough, and they engaged in pitched street battles with the left-wing militias of the communists and socialists in Germany, many of whom they killed. They sincerely believed that by elevating Adolf Hitler to power, they would be breaking the back of the powers of international finance, usually linked to Jews, and the corporate interests in general. Nothing could be further from the truth. In point of fact, Hitler and the Nazi Party was the ultimate manifestation of the corporate power, and it was the ultimate manifestation of the very things that the social revolutionary wing, the National Bolsheviks, the cutting edge, along with the rest of the Nazis of the Conservative Revolution, they were working, in fact, for the very thing that they thought they were working against. So, too, to sort of jump ahead and give you a thumbnail synopsis of the lecture this evening so that people understand what it is that I'm driving at if you're forced to leave early. The militia movement today, I think, in many ways corresponds to the social revolutionaries of Weimar Germany and the National Bolsheviks. The key difference, of course, is that whereas the people within the militia movement, whether the people within the social revolutionary wing of the Nazi Party thought that they were actually working for a form of socialism, hence the name National Socialism, it was meant to deceive people. In fact, they were working for the exact opposite. They were working for the ultimate corporate totalitarian political philosophy. Today, within the militia movement, there are a few liberals, maybe even a few leftists, but for the most part, they are a mixture of outright raving fascists and Nazis and many sincere conservatives and patriots, although generally badly misinformed. And I believe that many in the militia movement, the conservatives within the movement, are being used and deceived in a fashion analogous to the way the social revolutionary wing of the Nazi Party were used and deceived. Of course, they believe that they are actually working for freedom and patriotism and democracy, whereas the social revolutionaries in Weimar Germany thought they were working to establish some form of socialism. I think that the militia movement and the National Bolsheviks correspond, the militia movement and the patriots within them, the sincere patriots, correspond to the social revolutionaries, and I believe that the militia movement is in fact a pawn of, in some cases, I suspect a direct and conscious extension of, but a pawn of the conservative revolution of Newt Gingrich. So again, in Weimar Germany, we have the social revolutionary wing of the Nazi Party, we have the National Bolsheviks, thinking that by implanting Hitler or by elevating Hitler, they would be overthrowing the powers of corporate capitalism and international finance. That just goes to show you how wrong you can be. By the same token, I think that the militia movement today has many sincere conservatives and patriots within it who believe they are sincerely working for democracy and justice and to get the oppressive elements of government off our back, whereas in fact, I think they represent the cutting edge of the conservative revolution of Newt Gingrich. And I think they are being badly deceived and used by people who in fact are opposed to the very interest that the sincerely democratic and patriotic elements of the militias are supporting. I'm going to be talking, too, about the Pat Buchanan candidacy, the militia candidate. And I think the ideological mystification, which was used by the Nazis, and that had perhaps its most dramatic manifestation in the social revolutionary wing of the early Nazi party, the National Bolsheviks, again, the cutting edge of the National Socialists. So, too, I think the profound and, frankly, rather obvious contradictions in the Buchanan candidacy, he's been hailed as the militia candidate, exemplify the kind of ideological mystification that is taking place today and which corresponds to the rise of fascism and Nazism in Germany. It is my considered opinion that the United States is now going down the same path that Germany went down, and I fully expect the results to be the same, barring dramatic changes. And I think those results are going to be tragic and catastrophic. I think the Jewish, black, gay, and progressive population of this country is going to be exterminated, and I think that will take place in other countries as well. As the United States, Germany, and other major industrial powers go fascist and Nazi, and I think the 21st century is going to be the Hitlerian century. I fully expect, and I realize this is going to sound like hell to people, but the truth is often unpleasant. I hope this will not happen. It would still at least theoretically be possible to avert it, but an awful lot of people are going to have to change, and I don't think that's going to happen. They're also going to have to get some correct information, and they're sure as hell not getting it, not from any side in this particular issue. I think the 21st century is going to be the German century, and as I indicated in my last lecture, I fully expect the global triumph of the forces of German National Socialism to take place in the 21st century and to completely dominate the United States. I think in the 21st century, as powerful as the United States is now, I think it's going to be a tree farm for Japan and a source of cheap labor and raw materials for Germany. And I think our military are going to become the multinational corporate equivalent of the Gurkhas. Those are fierce Nepalese colonial troops used by the British to suppress rebellion in various parts of the British Empire. And I think our preeminent military is going to be used in a very similar fashion here. Again, I think that the ideological mystification which we saw in Weimar Germany with regard to using the social revolutionary wing of the Nazi party to install Hitler, and by the way, I should not lose sight of what happened. As soon as they installed Hitler in 1934, there took place the Night of the Long Knives, in which the social revolutionary wing of the Nazi party under Gregor Strasser was liquidated. I think the conservatives within the militia movement face a similar situation. I think they are being deceived, and I think they represent the cutting edge of the conservative revolution, just as the National Bolsheviks and Nazis were the cutting edge of the conservative revolution. And I think once the fascists are in power and once the polarization and stratification has taken place, I think the militias or the conservatives within the militia movement are going to be liquidated, either driven underground or perhaps killed outright. I also want to hold out the possibility of another phenomenon taking place. I've talked in the past about some of the international fascist and Nazi connections, including the German Nazi connections to the militia movement or to fascist elements within it, and some of the connections that have come out in the course of the Oklahoma City bombing. I'll talk about those briefly later. One of the ways the Nazis were able to conquer some of the countries they conquered, and when I talk about Nazis, I mean German Nazis in the Hitler period, was by enlisting the aid of powerful interests within those countries who were opposed to the prospects of socialism and democracy. In particular, the rapid capitulation of France following the Nazi invasion in 1940, France, at least on paper, a militarily superior power to Germany, although I think tactically it was deficient, that was accomplished in no small measure because the French general staff and the French industrialists, financiers, and aristocrats were basically pro-fascist and pro-Nazi. The Nazis had established a very powerful fifth column movement in France. France was at that time under the government of a fellow named Léon Blum, who was a democratic socialist who put together a social front consisting of a spectrum running from doctrinaire communists on the left through sincere conservative social democrats, but people who believed in democracy along the middle to center right. Many of the most powerful interests in France, including the generals, were more afraid of democratic socialists and Léon Blum within their own country than they were of neighboring fascists. Plus, many of the most powerful industrial and financial interests in France were already in bed with their counterparts in Germany, with whom they were doing business. So the rapid capitulation of France was due in no small measure to the subversion of France by a fascist movement within it. There was an abortive fascist coup in 1938 in France when the Cagoulards, the so-called Hooded Ones, a group of clandestine fascists who, along with the Croix de Feu, the Cross of Fire, attempted to overthrow the Social Front of Léon Blum in 1938. Later, many of the members of the Cagoule, many of the members of the clandestine French fascist movements, became key officials with the Vichy collaborationist government, the fascist collaborationist government, under the Nazi occupation. I want to suggest the possibility that the Nazi and fascist elements within the militia movement may also correspond as an historical analogy to the Cagoule, to the underground fascist movement within France that subverted France for Germany, because there are some very significant indications that elements, the fascist elements within the militia movement, are connected to fascist elements within Germany as well. Indeed, I've spoken about the fact that Ewald Altans, one of the top German Nazi leaders, was known to have been interfacing with the Michigan militia in the months prior to Oklahoma City, and that members of the Michigan militia had been taking military training with some of Ewald Altans' Nazi group in Germany. Altans was the protege of Otto Ernst Rehmer, an SS officer, a member of the Liebstandarte Adolf Hitler, an SS regiment that grew, was Hitler's personal bodyguard, and grew into one of the most feared and militarily accomplished of the Waffen-SS regiments. Rehmer was the fellow who executed the July 20th, 1944 conspirators against Hitler. He later became the unofficial spokesperson of the Odessa movement within Germany. That's the very powerful SS underground in Germany. And Ewald Altans is his protege. He was one of the top German Nazi leaders. Interestingly enough, after Oklahoma City, Spiegel, one of the top German news weeklies, published an article alleging that Ewald Altans was an agent of the Verfassungsschutz, a domestic German intelligence agency, which, if true, raises more questions than it answers. I would also note that something that I took stock of in my last lecture, 2 weeks before Oklahoma City, Timothy McVeigh called a white supremacist compound in Oklahoma called Elohim City. The fellow he asked for there was one of the security directors, a fellow named Andreas or Andy Strassmeyer. Strassmeyer is the son of Gunter Strassmeyer, who in turn was the son, is the son of, or no, I should say Andy Strassmeyer is the son of Gunter, who was Helmut Kohl's former chief of staff, okay? Strassmeyer admits knowing Timothy McVeigh, however, he says he was not involved in the Oklahoma City bombing, but interestingly enough, as I pointed out in my last lecture, he said he didn't want to run his mouth because he said that gets you in trouble. Well, who is he afraid of? He's not afraid of Tim McVeigh or Terry Nichols. They're in prison, and supposedly those are the only two people involved. He's afraid of somebody or something, and it sure as bloody hell isn't the people we're being told committed that bombing. And as I've indicated in the past, vis-a-vis Oklahoma City, I have more questions than answers, but the logistics of that crime certainly seem to be far greater than any two individuals could have pulled off, regardless of their military capabilities. We're going to talk about Elohim City and some of the connections. Bear in mind that the attorney for Andy Strassmeyer, who liaised between Andy Strassmeyer and his father, Gunter, Strassmeyer, by the way, says he was attracted to Elohim City, that's a white supremacist compound that believes in identity Christianity, by the alternative lifestyle, quote unquote. Well, that's one hell of an alternative lifestyle, you know, it's a wonderful little euphemism, but, the fellow who liaised between Andy Strassmeyer and his father, Helmut Kohl's former chief of staff, okay, was a fellow named Kirk Lyons, an American Nazi attorney who also represents Louis Beam, a key Aryan Nations functionary and one of the authors of the leaderless resistance strategy, about which I will have more to say later on. But given some of the apparent German Nazi and fascist connections to the Nazi and fascist elements within the militia movement, and again, the militia movement is a mixed bag, as I've indicated, with many sincere, albeit generally badly misinformed conservatives, A point I want to stress very heavily, because I'm not going to be able to dwell on it given the ambitious scope of the lecture this evening, I want to suggest at least the possibility that the Nazi and fascist elements within the militias and their corresponding sympathizers within the governments may very well represent something analogous to the Cagoulards, the French fascists who attempted to overthrow France in 1938 with, by the way, a series of terror bombings and assassinations. They ultimately helped subvert the French military resistance to Hitler's invasion. Many of them became key officials of the Vichy fascist collaborationist government. I want to suggest the possibility, again, the working hypothesis, and I'm not saying this is, I'm asking is it, that perhaps the Nazi and fascist elements within the militias may correspond to the Cagoule, to the Nazi Fifth Column in France, and that they may be bringing about a similar political catastrophe in the United States as well. Indeed, one of the possibilities I hold open is that for all of the flapdoodle we heard about the militias, right, in the aftermath of Oklahoma City, now the government's saying, well, it's these two lone nuts in the same military unit, and their informant, also one of their former army buddies, is telling us all about it. Well, the logistics are too great for two people to have done it. I wonder whether perhaps some of the international connections, including evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of German intelligence, with the Verfassungsschutz Ewald Altons connection, if Spiegel is correct, and the fascinating connection between Andy Strassmeyer and Timothy McVeigh. Strassmeyer admits knowing McVeigh, okay? How do they get to know each other? I wonder if perhaps that's one of the things that's being covered up, because if we examine the circumstances surrounding Oklahoma City, we see evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of the corridors of power in Germany, one of the most, I believe, personally, that Germany is already at this point the dominant power on Earth. I believe Germany effectively controls the United States. I've talked about the underground Reich, both from an economic, political, and national security standpoint in the past. This is one of the things that, for a full fleshing out, I think people should get some of my other lectures. I really haven't got time to go into that this evening, but there's no way we're going to get finished. Now, I think in order to understand the militia movement and some of the contradictions in it, I think it's important to understand briefly the history of American fascism, and indeed fascism is not something alien to the United States, and in particular to understand the evolution of the paramilitary right, and that's what I'm going to attempt to do in the first part of the lecture. Because indeed, in understanding the evolution of the paramilitary right, one has to understand that much of it grew out of the forces of American fascism in the pre-World War II and World War II periods. Much of it grew out of elements within the American General Staff, the MacArthur Group in particular, that I've lectured about in the past. And by the way, there's information available from the archives on audio tapes that'll flesh out from documentary sources the things that I'm speaking about. I also want to stress, too, as we will see later on in the lecture, that the paramilitary right historically has been used by the government. It's been used by the intelligence community and the military for covert operations. It has been used, or elements of it have been used. That's an important distinction. Elements of it have also apparently been used at low levels in some of our political assassinations, which were domestic intelligence operations. We're going to examine a bit of that history because I think that in all probability the militias are being used in a similar fashion, and that the fascist elements within the militias, the diversity of the militia movement, I hope I've already set forth, that fascist elements are in fact functioning as an extension of the very worst elements of the government, and indeed an extension of the conservative revolution of Newt Gingrich, just as the National Bolsheviks functioned as an extension, and the social revolutionary wing of the Nazi Party functioned as an extension of the Conservative Revolution in Weimar Germany. We should remember, of course, that fascism is not something alien to the United States. Many of our most powerful industrialists and financiers supported Hitler and Mussolini because of the doctrinaire anti-communist, anti-labor, and corporatist element of fascism. Also, the Nazi racial laws, which led to the Third Reich's extermination programs, were crafted upon and were supported, based upon and supported by American eugenics legislation and American eugenics thinkers. I've detailed that connection in past lectures, including a lecture about Proposition 187 and the international eugenics movement that I gave in November of 1994. Boy, that seems like just a short time ago, and it's already 3 years ago in terms of the calendar. We should understand again that fascism is not something alien to the United States. Many of our most powerful industrialists and financiers wanted a Hitler or Mussolini-like government in this country, and in fact they tried to do just that in 1934. There was an abortive fascist coup in the United States based around industrial and financial interests grouped around the House of Morgan, primarily the DuPonts and their supporters. Everybody knows the DuPonts own DuPont Chemical, one of the largest chemical companies in the world. They also own, by the way, Conoco, the sixth largest oil company in the United States, and they own a small automobile concern called General Motors. Perhaps some of you have heard of that. Well, they were very, very powerful interests, obviously, and when you combine them with the Rockefellers, the Mellons, and the other dominant families, the Fords, all of which were pro-fascist, you're dealing with a tremendous concentration of economic power. The House of Morgan and its related interests tried to overthrow Roosevelt in 1934. There was an abortive fascist coup. They wanted to set up a corporate state along the lines of Mussolini's dictatorship in Italy. They tabbed a fellow named Smedley Butler, a two-time winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor, a sincere conservative, an individual who was bitterly critical of Roosevelt, but who was appalled at the notion of overthrowing the legitimate constitutional authority and the commander-in-chief, for whom he had risked his life in numerous campaigns. He betrayed the fascist conspiracy to Roosevelt, and there was then a congressional committee, the McCormick-Dickstein Committee, which investigated it, although, as was the case with the House Select Committee on Assassinations and the Iran-Contra Investigating Committee, it was badly attenuated and was swept under the rug. The individual that the conspirators wanted to lead the fascist coup was General Douglas MacArthur. He was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was also the son-in-law of Edward Stotesbury, an American fascist and key Morgan partner who had been a financier of various American fascist groups in the United States. But he was the fellow who led the bonus, the repression of the bonus army. The bonus marchers were World War I veterans who had been promised some money in exchange for their service in World War I. When the Depression hit, they gravitated to Washington, camped out in Washington, demanding their bonus. They didn't get their bonus. What they got were bullets and bayonets from the United States Army in which they had served, and the troops who crushed the bonus marchers and who did so very bloodily were led by General Douglas MacArthur. For this reason, the conspirators didn't think that the troops would align behind Douglas MacArthur. They didn't think that MacArthur could muster enough support because of his suppression of the bonus army. They were in all probability correct. Their second choice to lead the coup was Hanford McNider, a former MacArthur staffer. Now, in understanding the evolution of American fascism and in understanding the roots of the paramilitary right, it's important to understand the MacArthur group within the military. Now, as was the case with the militias, I want to stress that just because someone was a staff officer on Douglas MacArthur's staff does not mean you were a fascist. I don't want to be misunderstood in that regard. There were many sincere Democrats with a small d and patriots with a capital P on MacArthur's staff, but the core of MacArthur's inner staff involved was comprised of a group of doctrinaire fascists, and we're going to talk about his most important officer, his G2 from 1939 on, a fellow named Charles Willoughby, nay Carl Adolf von Zschäpe und Wiedenbach, and if that doesn't sound like an Anglo-Saxon name, you're right. I'm going to talk about him in a minute. It's important to note that on Douglas MacArthur's staff, there was a core of fascist-minded officers and a second level of extreme conservatives who became converted to fascism during the follow-up to the Korean War, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Among the fascist staff officers on MacArthur's staff, a fellow named George Van Horn Moseley, who conspired with Third Reich intelligence to overthrow the American government, a fellow named General Courtney Whitney, who was a raving anti-Semite. Upon hearing criticisms of Douglas MacArthur, said that guy must be a kike. I mean, he's just a raving anti-Semite. A fellow named Albert Wiedemeyer, I think it's Cody Wiedemeyer, but that's his middle name. Albert Wiedemeyer, a fellow who studied at the German Military Academy, who rented his apartment in Berlin from Gerhard Rossbach, the leader of the stormtroopers, along with Ernst Röhm, a fellow who became one of the functionaries, prime movers in post-World War II American fascism. Among the other fascist staff officers on MacArthur's staff, well, I've already talked about George Van Horn Moseley. There was also a second echelon of people like Pedro del Valle, George Stratemeyer, Lemuel Shepard, also a colonel, a very important name to remember in discussing the evolution of the paramilitary right, William Potter Gale. Remember that, because Potter Gale was a guerrilla leader in the Philippines. He was a loyal MacArthur staffer. He also became one of the prime movers in the paramilitary right and American fascism and the Gale forces, so to speak, in many ways are the ontogenetic predecessors of today's militia movement and the fascist elements within it. We should also discuss briefly a couple of domestic American fascist movements. One, the Silver Shirts of William Dudley Pelley, last name P-E-L-L-E-Y, a 15,000-strong movement patterned after the Nazi stormtroopers. Pelley was sentenced to 6 years in prison for conspiring, like George Van Horn Moseley, with Third Reich intelligence to overthrow the government of the United States. One of his key functionaries, a member of the Silver Shirts, was a fellow named James Wickstrom, W-I-C-K-S-T-R-O-M. Remember that, because Wickstrom is one of the fellows you see quoted. In fact, I saw him quoted in the L.A. Times as a member of the Patriots Network today, after Oklahoma City. James Wickstrom, W-I-C-K-S-T-R-O-M, the founder of the Posse Comitatus, a radical right tax protest group that made a lot of hay, no pun intended, in the economically depressed farm belt in the 1980s. Bear in mind that this, quote, patriot, unquote, had been part of a fascist political movement that attempted to overthrow the United States government on behalf of Nazi Germany in the late 1930s and early 40s. If that's patriotism, I'd hate to see treason. But he's one of the main spokespersons of the, quote, patriots, unquote, networks today, many of whom are patriots, and I want that understood. But many of them are not patriots, and Wickstrom's an example of that. Also, Gerald L.K. Smith, of the Christian Mobilizers, a former Silver Shirt, he put out the cross and the flag. One of the individuals who spans the bridge, spans the gap between pre-World War II and World War II era American fascism, right on up to the contemporary period. One of Smith's financial backers was Henry Ford, who also was one of Adolf Hitler's earliest financial backers. One of his proteges was a guy named Wesley Swift, who was an American fascist, very active in the Southern California and Los Angeles area. And two of Swift's colleagues and proteges were William Potter Gale, again the MacArthur staffer that I spoke about, and Richard Gert Butler, the granddaddy, so to speak, the fellow who presides over the Aryan Nations compound in Hayden Lake. Many of the fascist elements within the militias are fond of using biblical rhetoric. I guess one could say that in following the lineage that Ford begat Hitler, then Ford begat Gerald L.K. Smith, who begat Wesley Swift, who begat Richard Butler, and William Potter Gale. We're going to talk about them later on. But bear these people in mind, because we're going to see some of the same elements evolving into the paramilitary right in the post-World War II period, and in turn we're going to see parallels between the paramilitary right going right on up to the 60s and 70s, and I believe the militia movement today. Now, we should note, of course, that fascism was not initially successful during World War II. The single most important name, I think, in discussing the success of American fascism and in discussing the evolution of the paramilitary right, one of the most important people, I think, in contemporary history or 20th century history, a name largely unknown to the vast majority of Americans. That is a fellow named Charles Willoughby, Major General Charles Willoughby, last name W-I-L-L-O-U-G-H-B-Y. He was born Karl Adolf von Chepe und Wiedenbach. He was a Prussian fascist, although he sympathized with his identity was with the Latin version of fascism rather than the Teutonic. Although German by birth, his idol was Francisco Franco, and he actually brought Franco to West Point to lecture in the 1960s and was an exponent of Francisco Franco. Charles Willoughby was an ardent fascist, a doctrinaire anti-Semite. He was MacArthur's chief of intelligence from 1939 right on up through 1950. Okay? It's worth noting that, because Charles Willoughby, I think, has played a much larger role in American history than most people think. There are indications that Charles Willoughby may have been one of the central figures in the assassination of President Kennedy. The best book about the JFK assassination, in my opinion, is The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell. A landmark work. I disagree with a few aspects of it, but it's a great book, and it focuses largely on Willoughby. As you can see, it's a nice quick read, some 780 pages or so. Something you could just knock off in a day at the beach. Okay, we're going to pause here while we turn over the tape. Anybody else who's taping, by the way, is...